There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
Right now, a historic moment. We can now project the winner of the presidential race.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
The president-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
Donald J. Trump is the president of the United States elect.
This is a political upset of huge, huge magnitude.
Country still divided.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back, listeners, to the 45th podcast. A lot's been going on this week. Let's start by introducing ourselves. My name is Rabia Chaudhry.
I'm Sarah Basha.
And I'm Susan Simpson.
So before we get into, and you guys know there's been a lot going on and much of our planned programming and discussion points we had to kind of throw out the window because of the strikes. But before we get started, I want to make a quick announcement because, as you guys know, we have switched from a biweekly podcast to a weekly podcast. And doing that will require your support because making a podcast has production costs. So what we've done is we have set up an account at Patreon. If you go to our Patreon page, it's www.patreon.com/45thpod. You will be able to become a patron of this podcast. What that means is you get this fantastic program every single week with a little bit of support from you. You can pledge whatever you want, $5 a month, $10 a month, $50 a month, whatever you think this programming is worth to help us continue to make this a weekly program so we can afford to have it produced every single week and not go back to biweekly, which could happen if we can't get the right support. To show us a little bit of love there and become patrons of this show. All right, so we're going to get right into it. I had a whole list of things that happened this week, from the Supreme Court nomination to going nuclear, Bannon's being exiled from the National Security Council. One thing I want to talk about was Jeff Sessions undermining all these consent decrees for police reform. I mean, there's so much happening, but you know what? We are going to just kind of pare it down to a couple of big issues, and we'll start off with Susan, who is going to take us into a discussion about unmasking, which really dominated the news cycle until Syria.
Yeah, so I have a theory that the whole reason this whole thing's taken off is that unmasking sounds vaguely sinister.
That it does, but can you first set us up and tell us exactly what happened?
Well, I don't think anyone can say that yet. But in an extension of the whole Nunes controversy, he was, in charge of the investigation into Trump and Russia, and suddenly he is conspiring with them to obtain materials from the White House that he claims aren't from the White House that supposedly prove some kind of spying of some sort on by Obama and Trump. After that came out, there was a limited recusal. Nunes is still the head of that committee. He's still the head of House Oversight for Intelligence. But he's no longer leading that investigation. We'll see what kind of difference that makes, if any. But having failed to sort of get any traction with that story, and after much complaining by Spicer and Trump that people were focused too much on how Nunes got the information and not what the information actually was, Trump has finally found a narrative that has stuck in terms of this whole Obama spied me thing, and that is Susan Rice. Susan Rice was the national security advisor under Obama, and she, mostly because of Benghazi, is sort of a well-known figure to the right, and Trump has managed to combine Susan Rice plus this word unmasking to create the appearance of some kind of scandal, which was getting quite a lot of airplay. I don't know if you guys, like what you guys saw about that or what your thoughts were.
The whole accusation here has been that there's been ex-Obama administration people that are still hanging around that are hell-bent on bringing down the administration. So it's not just Rice, but apparently lots of stray people that are still around trying to, get involved in ways that will get rid of Trump's, or bring down the House. So.
Or do something.
Right. There is that conspiracy. But I think on the issue of Susan Rice, what I understand is that the allegation is that she specifically asked that the names of U.S. citizens that were part of that were collected, as part of these communications with Russian contacts, that their names be unmasked. And then I think the rest of the allegation is then she was complicit in disseminating those names among the intelligence community. Now, I don't know to be honest, because I haven't been able to follow it very closely. Like, what the origin of this? Like, why Susan Rice?
So as far as we can tell, because again, right now, what we're basing this all on is on fragments of reports from various like leak sources. This time, the leaks are mostly like Trump side. It's Trump linking the stuff. So we're building what we know off these kind of brief fragments. What we think we know is that from November to January, so after election, before inauguration, there was interception going on of foreign communications. So hypothetically, you have two Russians calling one another, and our intel services are intercepting those calls and getting intel from them. Now, in some of those calls, we know that the two foreign actors that were talking or emailing or whatever communication it was were talking about Americans. And in other communications, in fact, it was a foreign actor having a direct communication with an American actor.
Right.
So these communications could only be intercepted in the first place because they were between foreign actors.
Right.
However, if you're listening in on, you know, the calls between two foreigners and suddenly an American calls in, that's considered incidental collection. And it is lawful, and you can use that under certain circumstances with certain limitations. So what we think we know is that, at least in one case, Flynn was talking to the Russian ambassador. Those calls were intercepted. And someone, we don't know who, compiled that information, and eventually it got released after it came out that Flynn had lied. He said he did not talk to the ambassador about sanctions. Well, he had. Someone leaked that fact, and Trump was forced to fire him. Now, from what statements we have from, like, GOP on the Hill, that was not Susan Rice connected. The theory was, so when you have incidental collection and you have these communications with Americans involved, you don't write down the names of the Americans. The agency that collects it instead masks the name or replaces it with, like, a, you know, generic placeholder. Typically, U.S. person one or executive branch official one. And when they pass out other agencies, those agencies can request to know the identities of the Americans or U.S. persons who've been masked. And that is what unmasking is. So at some point, someone got a transcript of a call between a transition official and the ambassador of Russia and said, okay, we need to know who this person is talking to the Russian ambassador about sanctions. And they would have found out that it was Flynn. Now, we have no idea if that was at all related in any fashion to any kind of leak, because there's other sources too for that name. I mean, unmasking, for all we know, has nothing to do with any recent events in Washington. And we also know from the Republicans that one actually wasn't Rice at all. So back to Susan Rice. What do we know? At this point, all we know is that at one point she got a report about a transition official who had communications with foreign agents other than Russia. So no Russia, but multiple foreign agents. And she requested to know the identity of that U.S. person who was a Trump transition official. Full stop. That's it. So it was those intercept communications that Nunes was shown at the White House and that he was apparently talking about. And this is the entire basis right now of the Susan Rice conspiracy. Again, we actually don't even know what official got unmasked or what was in those reports that she was reading and asked for an unmasking in. Unmasking sounds like it's bad. People hear unmasking and assume it's wrongful conduct. It's not. It's normal. There's nothing wrong about unmasking. It's an important part, a necessary part of the National Security Advisor's job.
I don't think if the request was made, it would come just from her. I think it would be more than one person. There's oversight in this stuff.
Oh, yeah. So when you make a unmasking request, it's not like you unilaterally decide to look at
the
name. You request the head of the agency, and they go back and say, well, here's the data we got. Yes, we can if it's appropriate to unmask this or not.
Who controls a narrative here? See, everything that we're pulling up was definitely, White House material on this. We're not hearing that much from the other side anyway.
Part of the problem trying to analyze what happened here is that we can't know what actually happened. This is why it's all a big deal right now. Trump accused Susan Rice of a crime. He said he believed that she probably committed a crime here when she cannot defend herself.
It's as simple as this. You know, when people make allegations, if there are actual crimes being committed, bring the charges, right? Let's test your allegations. So if Donald Trump is making this accusation, like you said, which is abhorrent if there's no basis in it against a private citizen, he's accusing her of a crime, well, bring charges. If you cannot bring charges, I don't think she has to defend herself. The fact that they're unable to bring charges means he's wrong.
They can't even describe what she did that was wrong. And I guess at the end of the day as well, the whole idea is kind of hilarious because, like, the premise that Rice could have engaged in unmasking as a political strategy is devoid of any sort of mechanism to pull that off. Because for this to even be a political strategy, it requires that, one, there is actual wrongdoing by Trump associates in their communications with foreign actors. And two, after unmasking the names of the officials that were actually engaged in wrongdoing, they hope that at a later date, after Obama was out of office, in an unknown way, in an unknown time, somehow that info would get leaked in a way that would make some kind of unknown difference in the media narrative or in Trump's strategy.
And in this case, if there was a leak, it came directly from Trump because he's the one who keeps talking about
it. In this case, we only know that any of this happened because of Trump leaking it.
Right.
The power of the media, you just put something out there and then it becomes a whole din about it. And you don't really know how it started, why it started, and what the facts are.
Well, what do you think?
And you keep hearing Trump saying this one's going to go big because he finally found a story that actually did start to get traction, probably because the word unmasking sounds like it's bad.
You know, but I feel like it's so short-sighted. I mean, like, if he has no proof that a crime was actually committed, how big can it actually get? I mean, it'll be a news cycle and it's over, right? That's the end of the road. What do they gain by, like, propagating this other than just riling up their followers some more? I mean,
he gets a news cycle and it's over.
And that's
everything
over.
They do is short-sighted. See, that's just how it works. There's no long-term visions here. There's no...
At the end of the day, we still don't know much more than we did a couple weeks ago. But we know that Trump was desperate to shift the narrative away from the fact that there was a lot going on in the Russia investigation. So the Susan Rice story worked temporarily, but it wasn't going to hold tension for long.
There's probably a lot more to learn. And I have a feeling the Susan Rice story will eventually just be long forgotten.
Could be already.
Yeah.
What do you do when you come back from work really tired and you have to worry about what to cook for dinner? Well, at my household, we turn to Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S. And because it ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, you have literally no food wastage. Now, I have three girls at home, and they each love to cook. We all know that cooking together builds strong family bonds, but research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly three times more often. This week, we have spinach and fresh mozzarella pizza with olives, bell peppers, and ricotta salata, sweet and sour salmon with bok choy, carrot, and ginger fried rice, Parmesan crusted chicken with creamy fettuccine and roasted broccoli, baby broccoli and fontina paninis with hard-boiled eggs and arugula salad. It's really nice to see a neat box at my doorstep on a day when I'm very tired that I know is going to taste delicious and it's going to be fun and easy to make. So, check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/45. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/45. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
So something else I want to talk about before all the Syria kind of crisis took part, and I, in a way it's connected to it because it's about that region, is a number of high-profile visits by Arab heads of state this week to the Trump White House. And I saw a couple of articles about this, and this is something I've been thinking about actually for a while now because as someone who, you know, grew up in the United States as an American Muslim, I mean, and Sarah can probably back me up because... Well, actually, I don't know, Sarah. I mean, like, I think there's a very different experience of growing up Muslim in the West because in our communities, in our mosque, we are taught very much that, you know, we should be connected to the global Muslim community. We are all one kinship and we're all looking out for each other. And we should be, you know, my entire childhood, you know, we grew up thinking about, oh, the Muslims suffering in this region and the Muslims there and the Arabs and the Chechenians and the Kashmiris and all that. And I just recently have been realizing that there are many, many parts of the Muslim world that don't give two hoots about American Muslims. And so that's what I've been really struck by with these visits. The first one was from the head of Egypt, president of Egypt, Sisi. And, you know, he met with Trump before the election in September when they both praised each other. And I that didn't surprise me because, you know, Sisi is a strong man. He came into power through a coup. As far as I'm concerned, he is complicit in, and not just me, but, you know, human rights organizations complicit in many human rights violations. But he overthrew a Islamist party, the Muslim Brotherhood, that had come into power through an election. And, you know, as I can see him being very closely aligned to Trump in terms of the kinds of personalities they are and where they stand on, like, Islamist political parties. So he visited Trump earlier this week, and they both had very nice words to say. But the week before that, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman also visited the White House, and he said, and I quote, "Trump is a true friend to Muslims. King Abdullah of Jordan was here this week, and he said, this is a strategic partnership that we keep close to our hearts. I am very delighted for your vision," he's saying to President Trump, "your holistic approach to all of the challenges in our region." And then recently, Bahrain's foreign minister said that Trump understood the region and threats posed by their common adversary, Iran, better than Barack Obama. So, what is going on here? Why is there so much friendliness from Arab heads of state with what I think is the most anti-Muslim administration ever?
Well, first of all, these people don't care about the Islam and Muslim rhetoric at all. They're thinking strategically. They're thinking of their own national interests. And if you notice, all of these people are on the same side of the coin when it comes to relationships in the Middle East. They're all pushing the Sunni agenda. They're all anti-Iran and Russia. And right now, Iran and Russia are a real threat to that region. I think they've been coming here to vet the president. I think they were okay with his election because they have objectives in their region that they feel that the Trump administration would help them to realize. So in my view, they might very well have been here to kind of say, look, the past administration didn't do very much, and that can't remain the status quo. Syria is a real threat. It's a threat even to Israel, and something needs to be done. So Israel's on the same page as these countries as well.
Do you mean to say Iran is a real threat or Syria is a real threat?
Well, Syria, the conflict in Syria is actually a rife playground for Iran. That's what's happening.
Sure.
The Iranian support of the Assad regime is undeniable. And I think Israel's been trying to ward them off on its border because it's got to worry about multiple things. So to me, these guys have been coming here because they've been trying to get the president to take some different actions than what the past administration had.
One of the common threads that unites all these people is that in their own regions, they are fighting, I think, what they consider to be some of the greatest threats to their own authority, and that is Islamist political movements, whether it's the Muslim Brotherhood, other kinds of movements, also fighting minorities. In Bahrain, we know there was a real crackdown on the Shia minority there. And they have very little tolerance for dissent. I think that they have that in common with Trump. I think it's unlikely that there's going to be ever any human rights or civil rights issues discussed between these administrations. In fact, a senior official said that the Trump administration has indicated that human rights will not be a public priority with these governments, and the most effective way to handle such issues was in a private, more discreet way. I wanted to read a quote by Shadi Hamid, who happens to be a friend, but also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute, and he's an author of a great book called Islamic Exceptionalism. And this is what he said about the idea, and Sarah, we'll get back to you talking about the kinship stuff and the friendship, because maybe I've just been naive all these years. But he said Arab governments are a kind of anti-Muslim in a number of different ways. As long as Egypt or the UAE or other Arab governments feel like they're not affected directly by the ban, and I would say, you know, all the other things that Muslims in America might be affected by, they don't care that much about Libya or Yemen. They think at least we're in the good category. There isn't any kind of fellow feeling with other Muslim governments.
Yeah, actually, Shadi Hamid also happens to be a scholar at Center for Global Policy. He's fantastic, and his understanding is right on point. Basically, from having lived in the area, you talked about American Muslims having this completely different approach to things, as in there's this overarching kinship between Muslims throughout the world. And that's that whole concept of the ummah. And I found growing up in the Middle East that Arabs are just as varied in their thinking as anyone else, and they're often not on the same page. And that's why we're seeing the problems that we see. And my understanding of the situation, and that's why probably I can relate to the conservative agenda a little bit more in that region, the U.S. conservative agenda, just because I've seen that they don't always get along. They don't always see eye to eye. They don't always care for each other. And that's the reality of it. And one unique aspect of my life was I grew up as an Indian. So my cultural outlook was always like I was surrounded by Arabs, but at the same time, I wasn't part of the Arab society. So I was able to look at them from the outside and more critically. And I have, as a consequence, in this country, always kind of seem to say, look, the American Muslim reality or understanding of the problems over there is very different. You guys are a little spoiled. You haven't grown up around that animosity or that differing opinion. You haven't had bombs go off and went, you know, not too far away and know that the ISIS threat is really real or that there's a lot of problems with people's, you know, dictatorial governments there. So you're spoiled
in that way. And I would actually agree that, you know, even the ideological issues that they have been confronting for years, which very much so, I think American Muslims have been in denial about because we've been in such a defensive posture after 9/11 that we were like, no, we don't want to touch the religion and ideological issues. Whereas Muslims back home, well, I say back home, but Muslims in Muslim majority countries really have had to confront these face on.
Yeah, and a prime example of that is sometimes when the Syria conflict first broke out, I'd be like, you know, I understand the region. So I was like, you know, Assad held things together just like Saddam did. Not that I was for that kind of system, but I understood that people lived relatively okay lives. They had jobs, they had education, they were just moving along with their lives. But when you take away that sort of stronghold that a dictator has, you're going to create power vacuums and ISIS comes. And so whenever I used to say stuff like that, I'd get jumped on and say, you're pro Assad. And I'm like, no, I'm just explaining the reality to you. It's kind of like every other place that has a strong man that's in charge, you know. So yeah, the reality of Muslims and Arabs on the ground in that region is very different from what American Muslims see.
So a fascinating parallel to this phenomena of the disconnect between American Muslims and Muslims in at least the Middle East region is the love and support of Trump by Israelis and Netanyahu, despite the clear connection between his campaign, his supporters, and a rise in anti-Semitism and hate crimes in the United States against Jews, and attacks against even Jewish cemeteries. Netanyahu said, Trump is a great friend to the Jewish people. And this was, I think, really to the dismay of many American Jews who were looking at Israelis and Netanyahu to say, hey, do you not recognize like the peril that we feel now because of this election, this administration? And I met recently with a friend of mine who happens to be a very well-known, I'm not going to say who it is, but a very, very well-known Israeli writer. He's been a writer for decades and his name is ubiquitous in Israel. He's very well-known. And when we met, he said something to me that I thought was fascinating. He said, you know what? This talk of anti-Semitism in the United States, it's bunk. He said, there's no danger to American Jews. This is just, and I kept pushing him. I said, why would they push this narrative? And I said, what about attacks on cemeteries? I said, that's not made up. And, you know, I'm like, we've seen the photographic evidence. And he said, well, that's been happening for centuries. As long as there have been Jewish cemeteries, people have been attacking them. He's like, but there's no real threat to American Jews. And he's like, at the end
Didn't they establish who that was knocking down?
No, they didn't.
Well,
no.
Not the cemeteries. I mean, that kid in Israel wasn't knocking over tombstones in Pennsylvania, right? I mean, like, there was a kid in Israel who was making prank calls, 19-year-old guy. But, you know, I asked him straightforward, I said, are Israelis not concerned about the exposure of American Jews to hate crimes here? And he said, honestly, we kind of aren't. He said, he is good for Israel, Trump is good for Israel, and that's our concern. And that was almost as shocking to me as the realization that whether or not this administration is good for American Muslims, most Arab leaders don't give a crap.
But you know, Rabia, their reality is very different. They're worried about their safety, their security, and their you know.
But how is that not there. How is that not tied? Especially with the Jewish community, I would say, how is that not tied to American Jews?
Because it's not about religion.
Because you're taking it from a religious.
No,
angle.
No, no. I'm not at all. I'm absolutely not at all. This is why, because they need Israel needs the American Jewish community because they need their support. I mean, the lobby that the American Jews have, and American Jews are by and large progressive, liberal, but when it comes to Israel, they are hawks on Israel. They are staunch supporters, and that political you know, support is necessary for Israel to even, I think, continue to have support among our politicians and legislation and the billions of dollars of funding. They get more aid than any other country in the world from us. That can't happen without the support of the American Jewish community. And if that support keeps eroding because there's this disconnect.
But I don't see how domestic that would go back to Israel. They're not going to withdraw support for Israel because Americans at home are feeling freer to express their anti-Semitic thoughts.
The support for Israel is not just from American Jews. It's also from evangelicals.
Evangelicals, yeah.
Christians, yeah.
Right.
So it's not just that. But here's the other thing. You're touching on something that's very, it's a growing problem even within the Muslim community, which is there's a difference, first of all, between Muslims in the U.S. and in the West and the ones that are back in Eastern countries. And then within the ones in the West, there's differences. So Jews will differ from, American Jews will differ from Israeli Jews right there. And then within that, American Jews themselves have differences of opinion. You've got the J Street ones and you've got the other ones, you know. So you're not always going to have people coming together in the name of the religion. There's obviously people have different needs right now. And honestly, Rabia, when you're being bombed, when you're being starved, when you're being oppressed, religion kind of goes out the window.
Yeah. So. It seems like authoritarian tendencies are the real uniter here.
That's what I'm looking at. I feel like what we're looking at, whether it's Israeli politics or Arab strongmen, that it is what connects them.
That but it goes back to this nationalist ideology that you can, you know what? The Jews can have their country, the Muslims can have their country, Americans keep our country, and we all be great friends.
Well,
in our own country.
Having done a lot of interfaith work over the years, and look, I'm a fellow of an Israeli institute called the Shalom Hartman Institute. I've studied in Israel. I've worked deeply with Jewish communities, Orthodox, Reform, Conservative. And I feel like what's happening now is like we're kind of, like we're on the same boat here and we got to start thinking about ourselves. And we have spent a lot of capital, emotional and otherwise, on who we thought were our kin overseas. And so maybe there's opportunity in this for us to do some real collaboration and coalition building back at home.
But Rabia, you've also been to Israel and, you know, we went on two different trips. I went with school and studied the conflict on the ground. But I did notice, and I can tell you this, that I'm not sure Israelis are necessarily happy people either. I felt like there's I think they're just as victimized as the Palestinians in the sense that their leadership is kind of like not very democratic. It's not democratic at all, okay? They have like a welfare system that's keeping them quiet for now, but the leadership of Netanyahu is not as popular as you think. It's known to be extremely right-wing, and I think it's just a temporary calm in the Middle East, even with just Israel. So they have a lot to deal with internally. They've been getting a lot of immigrants from different places. Israel's made up of, you know, Jewish immigrants from different places, but it's also got substantial problems with that welfare state that it's running. It's not going to last forever. And so I see them as victims just as much as I see sometimes, you know, any other dictatorial regime in the Middle East.
Well, I don't know if I can go to that extent. I can't. I mean, this is a whole different can of worms that you're opening up. And I don't think I can certainly agree there. I understand what you're saying. I think Israelis are by and large held hostage by their right-wing elements, just as we have been. I think this is kind of a phenomenon that's happening globally. But having said that, they are not under occupation. They are living rather freely. They have, I mean, and I will say that even for Palestinians living in Greater Israel, you know, we have met with them. We visited many folks' homes. We've even visited a place called the Arab Triangle, which is mostly an establishment of Arab towns and villages, Palestinian towns and villages in Greater Israel. And they are living much, much more comfortable and secure lives than Palestinian occupied territories.
Because it's a welfare state. And they've been given all those things for now.
Those are kind of my reflections on the recent Arab, the visits of Arab states. And I want to see how many more fall into line behind Trump in the coming weeks. I don't have to tell listeners of the 45th podcast that now more than ever, it's important to stay informed and keep learning about what's happening in the world across a wide range of topics. I do that not just by obsessively watching the news, but also by watching wonderful video courses from The Great Courses Plus, and I want you guys to sign up too. By signing up, you get unlimited access to over 8,000 engaging video lectures presented by award-winning experts on any topic that you're interested in. Law, history, science, politics, even how to cook and take better pictures, stuff that's maybe not as quite as serious as what we talk about here, but still important. You can stream these videos from your smartphone, your tablet, your laptop, TV, and you can start and pick up again from any device. I've been watching lately the history of the Supreme Court. The political battle over the nomination of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, you know what? It doesn't come in a vacuum. There's a reason there was so much back and forth on this nominee because the stakes here are really high. And the people who occupy the Supreme Court make an impact not just on our lives, but for generations to come. And this fantastic, highly rated course on the Great Courses Plus with 36 lectures will tell you exactly why. You'll learn why, even though today the Supreme Court of the United States is the most powerful, prestigious judicial institution in the world, it didn't start out that way. So sign up for the Great Courses Plus because as a listener of the 45th, you will get a free trial if you use our special URL. It's thegreatcoursesplus.com/45. Sign up today for the Great Courses Plus. I promise you will love it. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/45. Again, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/45. All right, so now we are going to move on to... We're still in the Middle East, but we're going to move on to the big story, and that is Syria. One of our listeners sent us a message that I thought was a great constructive criticism that said, you know, you guys give us a lot of your opinions. I'm here for facts. Give me some facts. And I think that's a fair enough ask. And so before we get into our discussion on Syria, what we're doing, why we're doing it, what we should do, I want to set up some facts to kind of give background and context onto what's happening today in the conflict itself. So the conflict in Syria began in March 2011, but really in February of 2011, so this is like 7 years ago, a number of children were arrested for graffiti and anti-Bashar things that they had spray painted by Syrian police, basically. And so when the townsfolk found out these kids were arrested, a number of them were arrested, they were being tortured, you know, fairly young, 12, 13, 14-year-old kids, they began protesting. And this also happened in the wake of the Arab Spring. So there was that fervor and momentum also happening. Well, those protesters were fired upon, and it just started escalating from there. And protests began spreading across different parts of the country. And Bashar Assad, much like his father, you know, just began clamping down hard. It was an opportunity. I mean, between what happened to those kids and their parents and that response, it was an opportunity for people who were looking, like in other parts of the Arab world where the Arab Spring had taken place, to bring about some change in the regime. And so they took that opportunity, and it didn't work very well. So for 7 years now, there has been this ongoing conflict. You can call it a civil war, but I think it's really, I mean, it has elements that are not from the country. There are many tens of thousands of foreign fighters also in Syria. And major conflicts have been happening in some of the biggest towns, Aleppo, Homs, and Damascus, where in 2013, there was also a chemicals weapons attack that actually killed, by some estimates, 1,400 people. And again, that attack was by Bashar Assad.
Which leads us, so the Bashar al-Assad regime belongs to the Ba'athist Party, which used to be the same party that ruled Iraq for a long time. So once Assad was actually, I wouldn't say removed, but he retreated to his one spot, he opened up all the borders of Syria to let in all kinds of fighters and rebel movements and I guess those pockets of power vacuums that were left were filled by Islamists. So it's a whole part and parcel of the Middle East searching for its identity. And a lot of times these Ba'athist governments and other dictators in the area were preventing Islamists from taking power, obviously. But what that essentially did was allow them to gain strongholds. And thus, you know, ISIS was able to enter Syria at some point. And it became a very messy thing because now you have not just ISIS, but several other factions fighting for control, sometimes up to 23 different factions. And I remember very distinctly, you know, talking to a Syrian journalist that was in the U.S. on a fellowship with my organization. And he was really frustrated at how the U.S. news was portraying the Syrian conflict in such black and white terms. And he was very frustrated and said, look, I can't work with you guys if you don't acknowledge the fact that it's not so simplistic. And there's at least 23 different factions fighting in Syria at the moment. So that's when, for me, it started to become a really kind of murky thing. I couldn't figure out who's who, what interests were in the area. And then in comes Russia at some point. And Russia, I guess you have to ask the question of what interest does it have in the region? You know, geopolitically speaking, also in terms of some of the agreements that it had during not just Bashar's time, but his father's time, in terms of oil and access to resources in the area. You have to understand that Russia is not an economically entirely rich country. It's obviously laying claims to the Crimea. Yeah, it's laying claims to the Crimea because it needs those resources. So obviously its interests are pretty strategic in the Middle East. So enter Russia, and then it gets a little bit messier and messier. But I think...
But the pretext is all fighting jihadis, right? For Russia to enter, and Iran.
The larger movement in the Middle East has been of Islamist movements, people trying to create their own system of governance. You know, it's a self-determination kind of move, and out of it is born a lot of stuff that's religiously based, which is extremely dangerous. And so Assad, I think, by retreating, kind of proved to the people, was trying to make the point that when I'm not here, you guys are going to be exposed to all kinds of dangerous Islamist forces all over the country. You need me. So I'm going to just wait over here until you need me to come back.
I don't know how that message could resonate when 95% of civilian casualties, Syrian dead, have been attributed to Assad attacking them and with the help of Russia, and not the same like jihadi and terror forces that he talks about.
Well, obviously, he is attacking rebels because in between all the Islamist forces, there are rebels that are trying to topple his government, obviously. And so he is attacking those. And yes, there's a lot of collateral damage, a lot of other forces that get into the mess. And that's why I'm saying it's not clear cut. Sometimes when we hear about
he's attacking hospitals. He's attacking hospitals. He's attacking civilians. I mean, schools. I mean, like, he's killing a lot of civilians. So we know that.
I kind of wonder what kind of a leader would use his own people to get this far. I mean, at some point, you've got to have some kind of, I mean, your dad was also a ruler of the same place. You've got to some allegiance to the human beings that are living under your state. It seems really heartless, but at the same time, it's a lot more complicated in the sense that there's rebels mixed in with Islamists, there's other foreign country influences. Like a lot of these people coming in from the borders are sometimes South Asian. They're coming in from Europe. They're coming in from different places.
North Africa.
Different reasons. And so it's become like this huge landscape for people's different wars in some
Well, sense. many of them are coming in because they feel that nobody's standing up to the Syrian people, so they are also under the pretext of fighting Bashar Assad and fighting oppression. And but at the end of the day, like ISIS, for example, is fighting. There's so much infighting amongst these groups that it has created a terrible situation for Syrians. I mean, we have at this point 6 million Syrians internally displaced, 5 million refugees outside of the borders, and close to 500,000 dead in the last 7 years.
Yeah. And you see King Abdullah, you talked about him coming here. I mean, that country is under so much strain. I mean, first of all, half of that country, if not more, is Palestinian. And on top of that, with this conflict, they are actually having huge problems trying to assimilate or to assist Syrian refugees. So there's a lot of strain on these countries.
Yeah, and same in Turkey. I mean, Turkey has, I think, at least 2 million Syrian refugees. I've been to Turkey many times in the last few years, and it's heartbreaking because you actually see these refugees in the streets, tiny little children, literally sitting in the gutters, Syrian children barefoot begging. It's heartbreaking because the camps can't hold them, so they spilled out into towns and places where they will be tourists to beg. And there is a lot of strain from the refugee population, much more in that region than there has been even. I would say the United States has barely felt it, although Europe is feeling it a little more. Like you said, because it's been so complicated, there really have been no good options. I mean, this all kind of went down under Obama's watch, but he wasn't really able to move any which way on the issue. When he did talk about military strikes, the possibility of that, I think immediately the response from the GOP was, we're not going to allow that.
It was, we're going to impeach you if you try.
We're going to impeach, right. So that was a pretty strong response. So he was getting slammed, but he was in a position where I think kind of Trump is now too, damned if you do, damned if you don't. Red lines were crossed repeatedly. Like I said, the chemical weapons attack in 2013. And then just a few days ago, the sarin gas attack in Idlib that's killed about 80 civilians. So
we should go back a bit first, though, because
okay, go ahead.
That attack, so back in 2013, when Obama came very close to doing what sounds like the identical strikes on Thursday night, there was a gas attack then as well. And ultimately, Obama did not go forward with the strike in part. Well, it seems like entirely in part because he felt that, the GOP essentially said, well, Peach, if you do this, you cannot go ahead without having authorization first. Nothing happened. But there were no more gas attacks until a few days after the Trump administration announced, you know what, Assad is there to stay. That's just how it is. So it is very fair, and a lot of people have noted, including Marco Rubio, that the gas attacks that recently happened were very likely in response to Trump's statements that Assad's going nowhere. He felt emboldened and felt like he could go ahead and perform these kind of mass attacks to reestablish his control over the area.
I think for me, this whole issue of the gas attacks and our reaction to it is not so much about, you know, us actually making a move now after all these years. I think the bigger issue here is we know that domestic policy is tied in very heavily with foreign policy. So my whole issue with this is, what made Trump suddenly change his policy on Syria? Was it the gas attack?
Can we just pause quickly and listen to what Trump had to say? Let's hear what the president had to say about the chemical weapons attack.
Launched a horrible chemical weapons attack on innocent civilians. Using a deadly nerve agent, Assad choked out the lives of helpless men, women, and children. It was a slow and brutal death for so many. Even beautiful babies were cruelly murdered in this very barbaric attack. No child of God should ever suffer such horror. Tonight, I ordered a targeted military strike on the airfield in Syria from where the chemical attack was launched.
Sarah, now, why do you think this happened? You think there's some domestic politics tied to this?
Absolutely. I think our domestic policies, especially on these issues, is very heavily tied to foreign policy. And the reason I think that this is less to do with actually wanting to save Syria from gas attacks is because look at the atmosphere in which we're having these attacks suddenly happen. First of all, we're all chummy with Russia, and suddenly overnight we change our entire course and our entire relationship with it. And how can that really even happen, right? First of all, it even shows that, you know, it's a typical thing of this administration to be one way one day and another way the other day. But
you say we're chummy, though, and this is, I mean, who designed, planned, and led separation is long-term military personnel who I don't think could be looped into this chum with Russia category.
This is true, and this is true. But look at the atmosphere in which we've suddenly decided to go into this and you know, attack the Assad regime.
What's weird as hell.
First of all, look back to recent happenings with Bannon being removed from the national security, very closely related to Flynn being ready and set to testify, and closely related to Nunes stepping down. And to me, it looks like I think the ties with Russia were going to get different light shed on them. And I think this is an outright, like, complete turn to show that there is no relationship. And, you know, it's not an outright war. It's just aerial attacks for now, for which you don't need congressional approval. So it's easier to do. But also, trying to distract, honestly.
I will say caveat there. There are interpretations that this is not a strike that needs prior authorization. But that's not a universal view.
Well, no, listen, I mean, it's a known thing that, and here it's a fact that Congress holds a power to declare war, but the president can actually send armed forces somewhere and go into battle without an official war declaration. So these attacks are not illegal. It's just that the process is, and the normal process is, you don't just act unilaterally, kind of like let Congress know that you're going to do this. We have people like McCain, who's been saying for a long time to limit the air power of the Syrian army, and he's all for this, right? But their aerial bombs, for now, there's not been an official congressional thing. We just jumped into it. And to me, us jumping into it is a deflection from domestic stuff that could literally blow the White House apart. It could actually bring down the government. So I think, to me, I know that's a huge thing to say, and it's hard for me to even go that far. But honestly, I don't know if this was like the time to be attacking, or this gas attack was something that was so, you know, moving.
I So first of all, there's a lot going on with the constitutionality of this attack and how it was authorized, what the power relied on was, both domestically and internationally.
Yeah, I think that's, I don't think
and
that's,
I would like, not say it's, yeah. there's, it's definitely not clear cut. Like any argument that there is an authorization of force in place that applies to this situation is really tenuous. Obviously, we've acted in Syria before, but that's against ISIL, not against.
Well, also Congress
another
hasn't.
State, right, another nation state.
Yeah,
but Congress hasn't been yelling and screaming at him. I'm sure that they
some of them
understand.
Have. Some have.
Some I mean, obviously, have. But honestly, is, okay. you have to admit that the military has been wanting to do this.
Oh yeah, but no, they threatened. Literally, the reason Obama did make a case that he had the power to do it, which in hindsight was a pretty poor bargain to say, I have the power to do it, but I'm not going to do it, which leaves the door wide open for your guy after you to say, well, the last guy said that he could do it, he just chose not to, so I'm going to go ahead and do it. Obama ultimately chose not to because there are strong arguments. And I think there's some very, they have, I'm not sure I come down to this, but there's some valid arguments to be made that he did not have the power to do this. And some in Congress now are protesting that he couldn't have done this without some kind of authorization.
And Susan, what is the biggest thing that allows authorization or gets Congress behind you is evidence, right? And this thing has happened so quickly overnight that there hasn't even been a chance to gather that evidence that we need. I mean, one side, obviously our side is saying Assad did it. You talk to Assad and the Russians and they're saying it was rebel forces. You talk to the civilians who are in Khan Sheikhoun, which is a place that was attacked, and they're saying they actually saw aerial bombs.
But that's the difference. That's not bombing against us.
No, but what I'm trying to say is nothing's been substantiated for us to have jumped into this so quickly. So to me, it's like, why so fast and why all of a sudden?
Well, I have to stop you, Sarah, because this morning I was listening to talk radio as I dropped my daughter off and I heard this from at least 70% of the callers and my mind was blown. I kept hearing over and over that we don't know who committed this chemical weapons attack. We do. Every international institution, organization, every government in the world, except for Russia and Syria, have confirmed that these were attacks by Assad himself. Let me just finish, because this is very frustrating to me, because what's happening now is that this alt-right narrative that is all these Russian bots on Twitter and on social media have started pumping, but it's being picked up now by... It's being picked up by liberals too, and liberals are saying the same thing. Liberals who are criticizing Trump, and that's the thing. Trump is being attacked by both sides. He's being attacked by liberals, and he's being attacked.
Okay. I'm not disagreeing. All I'm saying is that when you start attacking, you have to establish some facts. The United Nations says there needs to be an investigation. It's not clear cut. It happened so fast. Okay. So all I'm saying is you have to substantiate the evidence to make these.
NATO this morning supported the strikes.
I agree. Yeah. Okay. But the thing is, that's what you got to take to Congress. I mean, that's unless there's like an immediate danger to us. Yeah. Right. So it's weird.
Well, that's the critical difference here is that we tomahawked Damascus last night because there was a threat to the Syrian people by the Syrian leader. That is not that's not a situation where the president's using his power under the Constitution to respond to a imminent threat or actual threat to the United States by a foreign nation. This kind of like responsibility to protect justification for unilateral presidential activity, that is far from black and white. However, I do think it's black and white here that it was Assad behind the chemical attacks.
Well, I'm not denying it. I'm just saying there's a process and, you know, unless there's an imminent danger of another massive gas attack or some security threat to us. I mean, how do you just suddenly go off and say they did it and just start? You know, you need to have a consensus. Now the consensus is kind of building after
the consensus of credible actors is that it was Bashar Assad. I mean,
I agree with Sarah though. You know what? He had enough. Obviously, he could have gotten the support because it's some of it. Well, not universal in Congress, but he has it there. He could have gotten ahead of time. He told Russia before he told them, so we had more time, which by the way I'm not criticizing. Thank God he told Russia. That would have been a catastrophe had he not. But point being, he had the time to get that kind of congressional support and chose not to.
I'm just saying it looks a little weird that you just suddenly change
right.
your tone overnight. You guys don't find that strange?
Not at all.
And that it matches with Bannon leaving, Nunes stepping down, Flynn about to testify, and all this Rice stuff that's been thrown in there. You don't think that's weird? And honestly, if you look at the landscape, domestic policy is heavily tied to foreign policy.
I don't think Trump drove this.
The popularity of our presidency depends on, and you know, how Congress sees it, how everything plays out depends very much on the types of actions you're doing overseas too.
And at times
of combat, we all come together to support our servicemen and women. So to me, it's like I'm going through this big struggle inside me, like, why so soon? Why a sudden, you know, change? And then on top of that, okay, but the military said we've been needing to do this for a while. So, and then I see those images and I'm just like crying.
I think Trump saw opportunity and used it after the fact. But I think that in his mind, he meant it when he said before, you know what, Assad's there, it's his problem. Which shows the danger of this kind of unfixed foreign policy, but it's not a foreign policy. It's just kind of this whim of the moment approach he's taking.
Reactionary.
Yeah.
No, I think he's been vetted for a while. Like, look what Rabia said about those Arab leaders arriving one after another. I think they've been trying to vet him to do this. And I think this was probably a trigger to make that, you know, about turn on it.
I don't think this is going to be, you know, look, we have experienced mixed messages from Trump, turning on a dime from Trump in the past. Mm-hmm. I think that's who he is. That's why I'm not necessarily surprised. It's terrifying because, you know, there's not a lot of stability when you have leadership like that. But I'm not necessarily surprised, and I don't see it in a conspiratorial light necessarily. But I do think you're right, Sarah. I think that there, all of these kind of elements coming together from the visits of the Arab leaders to Bannon's place and national security. I mean, I can see how all of these coming together could have impacted that decision. I don't know personally. I mean, I've seen people say that, you know, he's trying to get his, ratings up. I don't think he's going to get his ratings up from this because is deeply unpopular.
Ratings up. It's about, look, we got to stand behind the president now. We're in combat.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I'll tell you why.
We've always done that. That's like the most predictable part about U.S. politics.
Exactly.
I mean, the alt-right has turned against him immediately. it's all over the internet. And that's his base.
When you've lost the alt-right.
Yeah. And progressives have turned against him. I mean, like my entire feed, the only place I'm seeing support is from like congressional leadership. Which is interesting, and from international leadership, from the UK to Australia, like I said, NATO. I mean, all of this leadership saying it was the right thing to do.
But the right thing to do in 2013. If it was the right thing now, that's what it comes down to, is that this is late. It's too late. This should have, if it's right now, then it is far too late because it definitely should have happened in 2013.
You don't think it can act as a deterrent to future use of chemical weapons, Susan?
I think that it's possible it can. I'm not sure in this context it's going to work that way. But the exact same argument applies far better in 2013. And we would have, you know, not had 4 years of what's been going on there necessarily. On the other hand, the absolute wrong move was to instigate this attack by telling Assad that you're not going to do anything about it. But once it happened, I do grudgingly, I think Trump heard people around him saying it has to be done. And I think I agree with them because you cannot have a chemical weapons attack that goes unresponded to in our current world.
That goes unresponded to, yeah. I mean, I think it's important to also point out that, look, you know, this chemical weapons attack killed 80 people. But Bashar Assad, using conventional methods, you know, bombs and just other, you know, without using chemical weapons, has killed exponentially more people. And so that's something we still haven't responded to or gotten involved with other than helping arm certain factions that are fighting against him. You know, I think at a minimum, this response, I mean, like I'm not an interventionist in general, but you know, we have seen over the last 7 years, like villages of Syrians holding up signs saying, help us, we are dying. What does that mean? Who are they talking to? I mean, like if we are the strongest military power in the world, we are supposed to be the moral compass for the world. We were late in Rwanda. We were late in Bosnia. We have been late here. But I think at a minimum, this sends a sign to the regime that red lines have to be, there have to be some red lines.
And you know, the message though.
I gotta say, I trust the military on this. They've been wanting to do this for a while. I think they know what they're doing. However, I also know from sitting in workshops and my work with the military that we're very good at our operations. But after that, what happens is the question. And we've faced this before. It's like what happened in Iraq. Okay, afterwards, what do we do? Do we know? Do we understand the landscape enough? Do we understand how to get stability and development in those areas, which are the only things that are going to help salvage whatever we went in to fight for. So,
nope, the answer is no. I don't think we can save Syria, and I don't think we can save the Syrian people. We can give a response when when such atrocity takes place, when it is like this unconscionable use of illegal weapons against his own citizenry, I think we can't stay silent. I mean, that's how I feel about
this. No, and it's a threat to all those nations in the area, to, you know, the Israel, the other Arab states. This is huge. I mean, you're at a this is a whole other different level of warfare.
It's not about Syria at this point. From what it looks like, to the extent that you can discern any kind of singular message amid the hodgepodge of his administration, which has had, like, what, 4 or 5 statements released that all seem to be contradictory on what he's actually trying to do here, the general, it kind of seems like they're coalescing or trying to coalesce around the idea it's about the chemical weapons, in which case it's not about Syria. It's purely a necessary message. I wish it was done differently, but saying, look, hey, world, no WMDs, you're going to get smacked. Wherever you are, what's ever going on, that's a rule that we do not violate. So it's not about saving Syria as much as like reestablishing that line.
Although,
is still there.
Making
this is the man who has said, why can't we use nukes many times? Let's not forget that. So I even wonder if he asked the generals, can we use nukes here? Oh, okay, we can only use tomahawks, I wonder. But let's talk about the other two actors in this, which is Russia and Iran, right? Russia was given a heads up, Susan, as you brought up, and that was probably a good thing. But
definitely
I also think
a good thing,
definitely a good thing. But I also think it's really not much of a loss for Russia here. You know, I don't think Russia has as much a stake in this strike as Iran and of course Syria do. So I think this is kind of low hanging fruit for Russia. And in a way, you know, if they give the heads up, or maybe they even said, "Hey, are you okay with this, Putin?" and Putin said, "Okay." It helps Trump look like a strong man. It shows that, hey, maybe he's not so much in bed with Russia, that he can't act against their interests at all. So I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
Well, also, I don't think Putin would have okayed this remotely. He might not. He's not like, it's not the worst thing that happened to him, but I think he's pretty ticked off right now.
Well, it depends on the tactical achievements by the bombing that we've gotten to. Maybe it's not a huge difference to the paradigm there. So maybe they would say, okay, I have no idea. But I can tell you that Russia's been trying to play this really weird role of, backing Assad, kind of being there militarily, kind of being there in terms of resources, but then at the same time trying to broker or be the broker between Turkey and Iran and trying to, you know, calm things down a little bit. So it's really, like I said, don't know enough about what's going on. It seems like there's so much power play between the Arab states and even, Iran, which is not an Arab state, but it's just trying to prevent the whole Iran infiltration into that area to a certain degree. And I think that's what's the bigger concern here for Israel and the rest of the Middle East.
The bigger concern is just Russia has zero regard for human rights. They are trying to establish geopolitical alliances that support their domestic interest. As with Syria, it's a lot about energy, oil pipelines, access to ports, and reestablishing control over that region. And they're trying to broker an alliance that will back their agendas, and it might not be necessary now, but to try and evade the effects of sanctions. And, God, this is such a mess right now. But the reason we attacked that airstrip is because that's where the chemical weapons attacks came from. That's where the planes dropped the chemical weapons, you know, flew out of. But there were Russians there that had to be warned in advance. The Russians are all over that field. They know about the chemical weapons. There's no way Assad would use them without their okay. Russia allowed those attacks to happen.
Yeah, look, the casualties were Syrian army casualties, apparently. So about 4 of them.
Huh?
Yeah, the casualties were Syrian army casualties. So I'm talking about the airstrip.
On the airstrip.
The Russians were definitely there. They were warned in advance. So was Syria. That's why they got all their stuff out of the way. Which is that again? That's a good thing to do. The tomahawks were a message as opposed to a military strike, in a conventional sense. But we
what
cannot.
Do you what do you think, Susan, of all the rhetoric that, you know, now that the Russians are really upset at Trump and at this move?
Upset.
I mean, so that's my problem is like, what's this going to lead to? This might have been a warning, but then we're hearing all this vamping up of the language, you know.
What Russia wants is a United States that does not intervene on humanitarian issues. They want a world order that's dominated by political power and monetary concerns and security concerns. And for them, this is a very, whatever the effects of this particular intervention are, for them, it's a disappointing sign that the U.S. has not abandoned its tendency to moralize. And that's the real threat to them, is the idea that America is going to step in when they commit atrocities, which that's what they were hoping to avoid.
Interesting.
Assad isn't the issue here. Russia's the issue. I mean, Assad is the issue for the humanitarian disaster, and that is an important component of this. But in terms of the global field, this is Russia versus U.S.
Right.
You know, you could even say it's Sunni versus Shia, because this is, for the Arab states, it's definitely Iran's influence in the area.
That makes us Sunnis?
Yeah, Sunnis. Yeah. This has been going on for, like, since I was a kid over there, the Shia right. Sunni things. Right. There is a definitely sectarian strife in the area.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about options going forward. I mean, like, there is a commentator on Twitter who I strongly recommend folks follow if they're interested on the Syria issue, but also on the region in general. Iyad al-Baghdadi, do you follow him? He's an Arab Spring activist, Islamic libertarian. He's a fellow and a scholar at, but he is from the UAE. His Twitter handle is at Iyad, I-Y-A-D underscore L-Baghdadi. So E-L-B-A-G-H-D-A-D-I. I follow him online. He, not long ago, well, actually in 2012, he created a flowchart, which he recently has retweeted, and it's been retweeted like thousands of times, about like the potential options in Syria. And they all look terrible. And that creates a real dilemma for the United States and for the people on the ground as to how this can be resolved. Two of the best opportunities that he thinks we have to help resolve this issue and bring peace to the region is either develop and enforce a total ceasefire. Again, no idea how that could be done. How do you enforce a ceasefire there? Or number two, the creation of a complete no-fly zone over the entire country, except in regions that ISIS controls. Thoughts?
I think you have to have cooperation from everybody on that. So I'm not sure that's even doable for any of those.
It would require Bashar Assad, I think, to step down. That's the only way I can envision a ceasefire taking place.
Well, you're assuming that there's not other factions out there that would have to respect the ceasefire, too. It's not just mm-hmm. him.
Russia's not giving up their interest there. They've invested a lot of time and money.
Well, also, there's tons of other factions that don't necessarily want to follow a ceasefire.
Well, they might not want a ceasefire, but I think the one thing they do agree on is that they don't want Bashar Assad in power. Then they would either have to fight it out amongst themselves. But Susan, you're right. I mean, like, would Russia allow that to even take place?
They might allow a new leader to come to power. I mean, they don't really care if it's Assad, but they're not going to allow, like, the direction they're trying to take it to be changed.
I would also tell the listeners there's a fantastic resource written in English. It's called Al Monitor, and it has it's a mosaic of journalistic pieces from all these countries in the Middle East, and it's put together in online as well. It basically allows you to see what's going on the ground firsthand. And I think it's, if you want a regional understanding of the dynamics and what each country is interested in, what's happening on the ground, that is an excellent resource. It's fantastic. It's a fairly new journal, came out maybe about 5 years ago or less. But it's fantastic because it's real, you know, reporting from the ground, and it's people from there. So they're writing it contextually accurately.
You know, this is uncharted territory. I mean, domestically, it's a fraught situation, but more so internationally, I'm curious to see where this is going. Because what just happened is America intervened in a foreign state over a purely foreign state's domestic issue for humanitarian reasons, with no security justification for the U.S. It was not a U.N. action. It does have widespread support in the national community, but it's not
right.
It's not a multilateral action. It's very possible it would have been, but with Russian Security Council, that's never going to happen.
Is there precedent for this?
No, not one that's good, because in our world order, as we're supposed to understand it, you cannot have one nation interfering in another nation's sovereignty, except perhaps in limited situations involving responsibility to protect and like action through the UN.
But you do have multilateral support for it, even if it's just one entity that's carrying out the operation.
Unofficial, though, and also it was not multilateral in terms of like going to the UN like you're supposed to. So this is not following existing rules. But because other states are responding with, you know, approval or not objection, I mean, Iran, China, Russia is objecting as usual, but other than that, I think it's generally broad support. I think this is a sign of a radical shift in international law. Not a new one, but it's one that up until now hasn't been demonstrated in practice.
What do you think are the worst case consequences here?
Oh, really? An outright war between the Russia and the United States?
What's the worst that could possibly happen between an international escalation of force between Russia and the U.S.?
All right, I take that back, damn it. I think there's a part of me that just feels, and maybe I am perhaps being short-sighted here, is seeing the suffering of the Syrian people for 7 years, seeing our inaction, and just like D.C. being paralyzed about what to do about this, I just feel like it's a long overdue message to Assad that, like, you know, there's a limit to the atrocities that we're allowing you to commit. And maybe it's too late, and maybe even it's too little, but I don't think it's, I don't know. I think it also maybe gives some hope to the people who are suffering at his hand.
I think what we have done is it's not delicately balanced, but I think when you make these big decisions, you're looking at the multiple angles of, is there a good time for everybody to be on the same page on this? And I think they've decided that it is.
And keep in mind, the track record for limited airstrikes is not very good.
So we got a lot of listener messages this week, emails and voicemails, mostly in response to our conversation on Planned Parenthood. And we are going to circle back to that, I promise. We don't have time this week to do the discussion on that or to play the messages. But Sarah, there was a message in particular that really struck you and you wanted to share with our audience. So can you tell us about who sent us that message?
Yeah, it was from Albert. And I just thought it was very nice. I think we got a lot of negative messages from that abortion segment that we did. So it was really nice to hear that because it was, it gets disheartening sometimes when the conversation turns a little sour. So thanks to Albert for saying what he said and all the encouragement.
And here's Albert.
I love the podcast. Truthfully, I'm not even sure I would listen to it as much if not for Sarah. I love to hear you think, Sarah. It's refreshing to listen to a thoughtful conservative discuss these issues. Please take any criticism as a sign that I listen much deeper to what you are saying. Of course, I have a great deal of respect for Robbie and Susan, and I listen to their other productions. It almost seems that we live in two separate worlds, one where the Republicans did not hear on Garland because Obama was lame duck, and the other world in which the Republicans would continue to do anything, no matter how unprecedented, to block anything that Obama touched. The fact that these two worlds can come together and create this podcast is amazing and important. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in again this week, and we really hope to keep coming to you weekly, but in order to do that, we do need your support, so please consider becoming a patron of the 45th Podcast. To do that, just go to our Patreon page. It's www.patreon.com/45thpod. Again, that's patreon.com/45thpod, and Patreon is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. A big thank you, of course, to everybody who helps make this show possible, beginning with our fantastic sponsors. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you to Ray Gaines for our audio production, our kick-ass producer, Mithal Thelhan. Thank you. You are the best. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Please do check out our website at www.45thpod.com. And you can reach us and leave us your listener messages, which we love to check into, at 202-670-8345. Again, it's 202-670-8345. Thanks again. See you guys next week. Experience of growing up Muslim in the West, because in your community, you are forced to believe that there is kind of this global, I am totally brain fried. What is the word I'm thinking of? Like a global, not a companionship, but like a global, like a
brotherhood.
Right.
Oh, don't use that word.
I don't want to say brotherhood. But okay. Let me just say this. As a Muslim girl.
Kinship.
There you go. There you go. So when you are a Muslim growing up in the West, in our communities, in our mosque, we are. Well, I mean, I think, look, there is a common thread. A lot of people don't realize many of these are, many of them are authoritarian regime. Oh, can you hold on 1 second? The baby is at the door. Hold on 1 second. Is he awake?
Did he wake up and, like, walk over?
He's awake. No, but the husband brought him over. I'm gonna nurse him while we continue to record. Irfan, give me the baby. I'll nurse him. I can't open the door any further. Just hand him to me.
This is so cute.
I'm sorry, guys.
Multitasker.
No, it's cute.
We'll get back to geopolitics in a second. Let me just get this guy on my...
little squeak.
Yeah. It stops being cute, like, in hour 3. I hope people can't hear. Here's, can I just say that, you know, one of the common threads that...